we have entered a period where security of supply in natural resources takes on the same priority that it took on in the decade of the 1970s, that scramble for resources between the North American bloc, the European bloc, and the Japanese. I think we revisit the race for access to supply.
Hi, folks. Wealthion founder Adam Taggart here. Suddenly, commodities are at the epicenter of the world's focus. They've now been weaponized in the recent international response to Russia's invasion of Ukraine. The U.S. and its allies are enforcing embargoes against Russian exports, while Russia simultaneously tells the West it won't sell to them anymore anyways. Given that Russia is a top world supplier of many key natural resources, the prices of many commodities are going ballistic, a number of them leaping by over 20 to 40% over the past week alone. Thank goodness natural resources expert Rick Rule is able to join us today to help us make sense of the frantic action currently playing out before our eyes. Rick, thanks so much for joining us today.
Pleasure to be with you, Adam. Interesting times.
They are crazy times right now. And look, I want to get to what's happening in the Ukraine, but before I get to the recent developments going on there, can you just set the stage for how the outlook for global commodities was before the war in Ukraine erupted? And specifically, if you could, I believe from your perspective, we were already staring at a future of tightening supply due to years of underinvestment in the natural resources sector. Is that correct?
Yeah, Adam, you'll recall a prior conversation you had 8 or 9 months ago where I laid out a thesis that said that societies had underinvested in productive capacity around natural resources for at least 2 decades, probably 3. And that the consequence of that was that absent a global recession or depression, that within 5 years, we were going to arrive at shortages of various natural resource commodities. In particular, at the time of that discussion, I was talking about the global oil markets, pointing out that as a consequence of people's carbon concerns and decapitalization of the oil industry and the very low oil prices that we experienced as a consequence of the COVID-inspired decline in travel, that the oil industry itself was deferring between $2 and $3 billion a day in new project and sustaining capital investments in the oil and gas space, and that the upshot of that would be increased oil prices. I wasn't prescient enough at that point in time to envision a war that saw one of the largest oil and gas exporters in the world come offline. But the circumstance that we're seeing throughout the commodities supply chain talks about just how tenuous that supply chain is. If you look at Russian production of platinum, of palladium, of nickel, of copper, of coal, certainly oil and gas, what you see is a supply disruption that cannot be met from redundant supplies elsewhere. It simply cannot be met. And what you need to understand about circumstances around capital intensive businesses is that our ability to replace that supply is going to be measured in decades without peace. The idea that, as an example, Russian supplies of nickel are constrained, so you're going to go build a bunch of nickel mines, forgets the fact that the Russian nickel mines, the Norilsk mines, are the best and highest quality mines in the world. That to replace them, we would need to go find the nickel deposits, that we would need to permit the nickel deposits, which in the United States or Canada would be a 10 or 15 year challenge, finance the nickel deposits into production. In other words, we can't impact the supply side for 10 or 15 years. I'm one who believes eventually that saner heads will find their way out of this confrontation in Ukraine and Russia. At least I hope so. But I think the instructive part of this is it's shown just how tenuous the supply chain is. If you look on the demand side, Adam, as we talked about 9 months ago, absent a recession or depression, demand is guaranteed. There's 7.7 billion of us on Earth. World population is growing. And increasingly, people at the bottom half of the demographic pyramid in the world want to live the way that you and I live. We've been successful as a species over 30 years lifting the poorest of the poor to the extent that they have more disposable income. And when they have more disposable income, they want a higher material standard of living, which means They want more oil. They want more copper. They want more coal. They want more steel. And we are probably in no moral position to deprive them of it. Think about 1.2 billion people on Earth who have no access to electricity. Think about 2 billion people on Earth who experience electricity poverty, meaning intermittent or unaffordable electricity. All of these people want electricity. All that means that there's going to be more demand for energy, all forms of energy. You know, solar, yes. Wind, yes. Nuclear, yes. Oil, yes. Gas, yes. Coal, yes.
All right. So you've done a good job of saying, look, even before what's happened in Ukraine happened, you know, we had some really unavoidable reckonings coming in terms of dealing with this growing mismatch between supply and demand. And you alluded to the fact that Russia being a major provider, a lot of these key resources with them coming offline, at least in the short term, that is going to have pretty strong repercussions and ripple effects. Given what we know right now, and there's a lot of uncertainty out there right now, but just to give some late breaking news here on the day that we're talking, President Biden did speak publicly and say that the U.S. and its allies were not going to be buying any Russian oil and gas for the foreseeable future. Putin then turned around and issued his own statement saying that no Russian natural resources are going to be basically sold to any of those countries, the U.S. and its allies, at least through December 31st, so through the rest of the year, right? So how much does this exacerbate the already serious problem that we were facing? You know, is it a moderate disruption, or is this pretty massive?
No, I think it's moderate. I think, you know, a few days ago when we kicked them out of the SWIFT system, we, in effect, anticipated this. The Russians aren't going to sell it to us if we can't pay them for it. Yeah. And so the fact that the Russians were cut off effectively from U.S. dollar-denominated banking actions around the world meant that Russia's ability to sell stuff to people and other people's ability to pay them for it was already constrained. This reminds me a bit of the president of Mexico saying that next year Mexico was going to shut off oil exports because they needed it for domestic consumption. It's because they haven't invested in their oil industry for 30 years and they don't have any oil to export. So what Biden said today and what Putin said today were very much political posturing. They were very much trying to gain political advantage from a circumstance that has been in place for a week.
Okay. Sort of like you're saying, you know, this was, the horse was already out of the barn on this one by shutting them off from SWIFT. The trade wasn't going to really happen anyways.
Right. Now, I guess a couple. I mean, we haven't faced all the consequences that we're going to face out of what happened a week ago. As an example, in the uranium market, the Russians are responsible, I think, for 15 to 18% of primary uranium production in the world and 40% of enrichment capacity. As an example, and although they aren't dominant in the world oil and gas business, they are certainly dominant in terms of providing natural gas to Europe, which after all is still in winter. So I'm not trying to minimize the impact of this. I'm only trying to say that the political action that Biden took and Putin took today were sort of irrelevant.
Okay, got it. Let me sort of restate my question again, just to make sure your moderate label still applies. basically, the fact that Russia is closing the gold window, the wheat window, the uranium window, the nickel window, et cetera, and it's such a large supplier of those commodities to the rest of the world. How much of a factor is that in terms of exacerbating the supply shortages that you thought were going to be happening over the next 5 years?
I think it's going to be massive.
Okay, so we're back to massive. Okay,
I really do think it's going to be massive. I think it's already been important, and I don't think that anybody really understands, despite people studying this circumstance for a long time. I don't think anybody really knows or understands what the ultimate repercussions are going to be. I need to say, Adam, over time, high prices are the cure for high prices. When oil prices stay high for a long time, people do an interesting thing. They conserve. And other people find a way to produce more. But until you have convinced people to conserve and until you've convinced other people to produce more, the dislocation, particularly in the European markets for oil and gas, are going to be interesting. they're going to be much more interesting in platinum and palladium markets, where the Russians are sort of 40% of supply. In nickel markets, the repercussions for this, provided that there isn't some way out, some political way out in the near term, are hard to calculate.
Okay, so I'm going to ask you some questions about prices, knowing that it's hard to calculate here. So sure. Anything you answer, we will dismiss as speculation with imperfect information here.
Right.
I'm going to put up a chart here for just a sec. It came recently from John Walden, but it shows the price increases in a number of raw materials over the past week. And you'll see they go everywhere from, and this was done before the past couple of days. So gold has the lowest price appreciation at like 6 or 7%. Of course, today it went bananas. And all the way up on the other end here, to wheat, which was up 40%. Now, those prices have gone dramatically higher, almost all of those, since that chart was published. They almost look quaint compared to the recent action over the past 48 hours. But it shows that prices are understandably reacting, you know, pretty tremendously to what's going on right now. And my question for you is the price activity we're seeing right now, what do you think is driving it more? Is it people doing the math of the sanctions and saying, well, this is the new price? Is it just panic about inflation, where people are just realizing that, oh my God, prices are going, continuing to go up. I got to buy them now before they get even more expensive. Or is it speculators who are, fanning the emotions here and driving things up to some sort of mania peak?
I think it's a combination of all of those. I think that there's important strategic buying in some raw materials. Platinum and palladium, as an example, the value of the platinum and palladium relative to the finished price of the product is so low that supply is what's important. Price isn't important. At current prices, it probably takes $200 worth of palladium to sell a $50,000 car. If you need that catalytic converter to sell the car, you have to pay any price for the platinum. It doesn't matter. And so there's a lot of price elasticity relative to demand. In those circumstances, people are less price sensitive and more supply sensitive. The same in the very near term with nickel, although it appears that there was a very big nickel short squeeze that took place. There was a tight physical market and there were financial interests that were short. And those people are having an almost religious experience with regards to their short squeeze.
Sorry, Rick, but just to interject, I'm gonna put up a chart here just to show people what you mean by that. Nickel, a month ago was trading sort of near its historic average of, around $20,000 to $25,000 a ton. As of yesterday, when they stopped trading in it, it was over $100,000 a ton. So, it went up five times really in just the span of a couple of days here.
Yeah, you have some commodities where relative to utility, the commodity is fairly cheap. And where the price of the commodity is not very relevant in the price of the product which is sold, where the price can go up and the price must go up, the price does go up. And we saw that in palladium. I think you say the same thing perhaps in uranium. The price of uranium might be 5% of the cost of delivering power from a nuclear power plant. So if, as a consequence over time of Russian shortfalls, the price of uranium had to go up, it could go up. Things like wheat and oil and gas become much more difficult because the market has to be much more price sensitive. The value of the commodity is much more directly related to the finished price of the product and utility. So I think that price action could moderate sooner. And there's an argument that goes that because the only readily fungible asset that Russia has is gold, because of the high cost of running a war, that there might be pressure on the gold price. While the Russians can't transact in US dollars, they might be able to transact in gold, which is fairly fungible, to buy what they need on those foreign markets, Japan, China, and India in particular, who will trade for them. So there is a school of thought, which you can't discount, which says that the supplies of gold on the market might increase. Let's say, as an example, that the Russians couldn't sell gold for US dollars, but the Chinese could sell their gold for US dollars and then replace it with Russian gold at a discount, you know, a $30 or $40 an ounce arbitrage. I could see that being attractive from the Chinese viewpoint, and I could see the Russians not having a second choice. I'm not saying this is going to happen, but it's something worth considering.
Yeah, and you know, I know you are a natural resources expert. I don't know how much of a geopolitical expert you are. You can tell us that yourself. But you know, China, India, I don't know about Japan either, but I'm pretty sure China and India are not signatories to this U.S. and its allies' embargoes of trade against Russia. And so, do you see Russia's, you know, a lot of speculation right now that these sanctions are going to be pretty economic crippling to Russia, and they probably very likely are. But will Russia still be able to take many of those products and sell them to some of those other countries that we just talked about, in your estimation here?
To a lesser degree, the renminbi is a much less liquid currency. The rupiah, from a global point of view, is an irrelevancy. So it's going to be very difficult for the Russians to affect broad-scale economic transactions, either for the stuff they need or what they need to sell for to pay for the stuff they need, absent the SWIFT system and the US dollar. Yes, certainly, they will be able to sell to Japan, to China and India. The Japanese have indicated with regards to energy and raw materials that they need to be pragmatic and act in Japan's interest, which I think is a different way of saying, yes, we'll buy it.
Yep.
But the fact is, if you're cut out of the developed world effectively, if you're cut out of Europe and you're cut out of North America, you're in a world of hurt in this economy, particularly if the only thing that you do well is sell natural resources and what we've now learned are defective defense systems. Your ability as Russia to afford to wage the war begins to be an issue. Many of your listeners probably aren't well enough versed in history to remember a small war 20 years ago between Ethiopia and Eritrea. Those hostilities didn't end because the leaders suddenly found religion. They ended because neither Ethiopia nor Eritrea could afford their fuel bill. Literally, they ran out of gas. And I suspect that it will be increasingly difficult for Russia to afford operating the Russian economy and operating the war. And I hope that will lead to everybody finding a way to talk.
Okay. Finding a way back to the table and hopefully negotiating something that is, you know, at least mutually acceptable to enough people that we can get as close back to normal as possible. So many questions raised by what you've just said there, but let me pull one from what I just said, which is there a way to get back to normal after this, or has the world sort of fundamentally changed by what's just gone on in the past couple of weeks? I'm hearing a lot of people say, you know, we basically just changed the way the world operates, no matter what happens next.
This is going to redefine how we view normal. 6 months ago, most resource investors would have said that Russia was progressing nicely in terms of being an investment destination. And with regards to precedent and the rule of law in Russia around natural resource investment, will we return to that normalcy? Perhaps in a decade. I think, too, that we have entered a period where security of supply in natural resources takes on the same priority that it took on in the decade of the 1970s, that scramble for resources between the North American bloc, the European bloc, and the Japanese. I think we revisit the race for access to supply. The thing that we haven't looked at that I think we need to look at is how we pay for this new economy. We already have a circumstance where around the world, we're funding our deficit on confidence. We're using quantitative easing, which if you and I did it would be called counterfeiting. We're borrowing from the unborn, and one wonders what size that credit line is. And we're relying on negative real interest rates. When the savers around the world understand that a debt instrument is, as Franz Pick said, a certificate of guaranteed confiscation, which is to say, when people decide that they can't afford to sacrifice their current purchasing power in return for less purchasing power later, the world reshapes. I would argue, Adam, that we've been in the period 1982 to 2022, the 40 most benign years of economic circumstance in human history. increasing world trade, increasing specialization, increasing benefit from technology, the demographic boom of the baby boomers, the input of women into the labor force, declining real interest rates, just a wonderful set of circumstances. And I'm not trying to say that the next 10 years is going to be catastrophic, but I am going to say in poor English, it ain't going to be that easy. You can't take interest rates substantially below zero. The baby boomers, rather than coming into the labor force and saving, are dying. Globalization has given away to nationalization. The only thing that I'm still comfortable with is information technology and the advent of technology. The good thing is we still have a world right now where five or six kids can commandeer a garage in Sunnyvale and out pops Google. And the better news, if you want to look past the war, is that with the distributed information and the increase in technology, increased living standards and education, that garage might be in Lagos. It might be in Jakarta. It might be in Sao Paulo. I mean, the really good news out there is that for millennia, individual initiative and tenacity has funded collective stupidity. And I think we might be able to squeak through this one too. But I do think that the change that you're talking about has as much to do with the unwinding of 40 years of benign economic climate and coming into a climate that requires a different outlook and different action on the part of investors.
Okay. Yeah, I agree. And I would say, you know, it was a period of benign economic outlook, but it was largely, you know, debt funded, right?
I agree with you. It was, I mean, negative real interest rates in particular and quantitative easing, we were able to consume the capital that we built up earlier in the last century. The only place that I would disagree with you is I think that the increase in living standards and the increase in productivity in the bottom half of mankind contributed more than we know. Deng Xiaoping saying to be rich is glorious unleashed, first of all, the increase in living standards across China, but also the Chinese economic might, which made the rest of our lives so much cheaper in terms of cheaper manufactured goods. And I think it's difficult to overstate the importance of the technologies that were developed in the last 40 years. And the one thing that gives me hope going forwards is that march in technology will mean that increases in output will require less capital inputs. Of course, war can destroy all that.
Right, right. And hopefully that can help on the efficiency side of things. The sort of where I was going on this is, correct me if you feel differently, but I think a very important metric of the next era that we're in is going to be available resources per capita. And the capitas have been growing and the resources are not growing as much as you've already laid out for us here, right? And so we're going to have both nations competing more for controlling the supply of what remains. And then we also are going to have, or could have, and I'd love to get your thoughts on this. We have been elevating a lot of those people out of poverty. They've already had a bit of a taste of it, right? But if we, you know, right now there's raging worldwide inflation and what's happening in the Ukraine right now, and you know, with these knock-on effect of these commodity prices exploding now. You know, that's what created the Arab Spring, right? Is you basically had these regions of the world where all of a sudden the economic opportunity decreased and the cost of living dramatically increased. And these people had really no other option but to rise up against who was running the country because they couldn't feed their families anymore. They couldn't heat their homes. So do you worry about potentially heading back into elements like that too?
I do. As you point out, I'm not a geopolitical analyst. I'm a credit analyst and a natural resource investor. So while I'm concerned about that, I have a couple comments. The first is that I don't think that resources, despite the fact they've increased in price, are expensive. I think they're still cheap. If you take the price of resources in real terms back to 1980, what you'll find is that resources don't cost more, the dollar buys less. Unfortunately, I think that trend continues, and I think that perhaps savers and investors and voters worldwide will misplace the blame and suggest that the blame lies on increasing commodity prices rather than placing the blame where it correctly lies, which is the legislature debasing the purchasing power of the medium of exchange.
The monetary policy, exactly, yeah.
Whether or not the world's voters become literate over the next 20 years is a bigger question that I'm capable of answering, but that gives me pause. Looking further, we went through this circumstance before in the decade of the 1970s. If you'll remember Jimmy Carter and Jeremy Rifkin and the Club of Rome and all those morons, they had the same Malthusian argument with resources and they forgot that markets work. The cure for high prices, Adam, ultimately is high prices. We haven't seen high prices yet, but I think we will. And I think the market will correct. I don't think, as an example, that we have a shortage of $120 oil. I think we have a shortage of $60 oil. And I suspect at $200 oil, if that $200, depending on what the dollar is actually worth, if we had a real $200 oil period for a while, what you'd find is that there's more supplies than we think there are, and we would find a way to drive less. In other words, ultimately, this Malthusian Club of Rome argument is something that might cause us real concern 200 years from now, but I don't think it needs to cause us concern 20 years from now. I do think that we need to understand that food and fuel and energy will return to norm in terms of the wallet share that they enjoy with consumers around the world. Remember that the stuff is really, really, really cheap in historic terms, and it's going to become less cheap.
Okay, I think that's great context for folks to have, particularly as we look out, you know, across maybe the remaining span of our lives and our children's lives here. But let's look at the next year or two. And I want to bring back two words that you mentioned earlier, where you said, you were talking about the how high prices could go, and you said barring recession or depression, right? So how concerned are you in the near term that, you know, with everything else that we had going on, right? We already had inflation from the monetary stimulus and the breakages in the world supply chains. We had the Fed at the ready to start hiking interest rates and whatnot. But now all of a sudden, you know, input costs are shooting the moon, right? So potentially is the way in which these oil returns back down to $60 is because we have a serious recession that just dampens economic activity that much?
Adam, I need to say that over the last 30 years, I have accurately predicted 17 of the last three economic declines. okay. I have always been afraid of deficit spending. I've always been afraid of the increased politicization of the economy. And I have always underestimated the resiliency of humankind. For most of my life, we cured economic circumstances like the one that we're in today, a liquidity-driven economy, with a good old-fashioned recession. We reset living standards and we reset demand. It would seem that the big thinkers have decided that recessions are illegal, and the voters have decided that the cure for the economy is not more productivity, but rather higher taxes and more laws. We'll see if that continues to work. A different circumstance is that it would seem that since I've been cognizant, which has been maybe 50 years, that every 10 years or so, we've had a crisis in confidence and we've had a liquidity squeeze. 2008 comes to mind. And I'm very concerned that if you normalize natural resource prices at the same time that you continue to increase the cost of government, that people's real living standards fall to the extent that we have a demand-driven recession. In other words, people run out of confidence and people run out of money. I hope that's not the case. I hope that we're globalized enough that the increase in education and the increase in productivity from younger workers in places like Nigeria and Indonesia float us old, fat, bald white people. And I, you know, I hope that we, that the ascent of humankind, that the ascent of the bottom half of humanity generates enough economic utility like the rise of China did, that we get through this. But I have my doubts.
All right. Is it safe to just say that you have concerns that a rocky patch lies ahead in the near term?
Absolutely. With the caveat that I've been concerned about that for years and I've been consistently wrong and hope I'm wrong again.
Okay. All right. Well, I want to get into sort of the investment side of this. We got a lot of people watching here who, A, you know, are worried about where things might go and don't want to get destroyed by a major market correction. But I think in every crisis, they say there's opportunity.
And we haven't talked yet, but my sense is that you may be looking at some areas here as saying, hey, this may actually do pretty well going forward, given the big macro events that are swirling. Let me ease into it through the energy door, if I can, because I have a couple of questions earlier I didn't ask that are germane to something you're involved in. So on the energy side, those markets are just getting highly disrupted right now. You know, we're slamming doors right and left on trade flows for oil and gas. As you mentioned earlier, Europe is extremely vulnerable right now to the decisions that are being made with Russia, because Russian oil apparently is 28% of EU imports for oil, and gas is 40% of EU imports for gas. So they are highly dependent on that right now. And as you talked about, you know, you just can't find new supplies overnight in this space, right? So I guess let's start there. From an investing standpoint, as you look at the oil and gas markets right now, what are your thoughts?
Oil and gas in the 3 to 5 year timeframe is a no-brainer. The oil companies are discounting probably $60 crude. And in the US, they're discounting probably $2.50 natural gas prices in a circumstance where the prices are $130 and $5.50 respectively. The oil price can fall and the oil companies are still cheap. That doesn't mean that if we have a resolution, a political resolution of the problem in the Ukraine, that the oil price can't fall, and that near term, the price of the oil stocks doesn't fall. I'm not talking about the direction of stock prices in the near term. What I'm saying is that the big energy producers, the Exxons of the world, the Chevrons of the world, as an example, the Occidental Petroleums of the world, the people that control a lot of non-Russian production are cheap on a net present value basis. And people should buy them. It doesn't mean that the share price 6 months from now will be higher or lower than it is today. It means that the companies are worth substantially more than they're selling for today, unless the oil price falls by half, which I think is unlikely.
Okay. And just curious, sort of the service providers in that same space, are you sanguine on them too?
I laugh because my track record with regards to service providers has not been as good as it has been around the oil and gas industry. I suspect that we're going to come back into a capital spending cycle in oil and gas. Right now, the higher oil and gas prices have not led to a dramatic increase in capacity expansions among the oil and gas business. Their cost of capital has risen as a consequence of the carbon furor worldwide. It seems that the banks listen more to Angela Merkel, Joe Biden, and Greta Thunberg than they do to oil and gas economists. And if we come back into a spending cycle for oil and gas, one would expect the Schlumbergers and the Halliburtons to do very, very well. I'm not looking for a secondary leverage play. For me, I'll make enough money in Exxon and Chevron that I don't need to be smart enough to own Schlumberger. For people who are a bit smarter than me, and mercifully there's a lot of them, if demand for oil and gas leads to an increased spending cycle in oil and gas, if we decide that we need to replace Russian production, then the service company should do extraordinarily well.
Okay, great. And I'm going to ask you to speculate here, but you know, we've had that drought of investment in the oil and gas space for a long time for a variety of reasons, but a big one being that a lot of the focus has been going into the green movement, right? Right. Let's get to alternative energies. Let's fund those. And, you know, there's lots of reasons to want to do that. But do you see that being forced to pivot a bit, given what's going on right now, where the world is really finally waking up, and Germany is probably the best case study of this, that like, hey, like it or not, we are more dependent on this stuff than we thought. And, you know, we're going to need more of it.
I hope the world's consumers say to the world's big thinkers, give your head a shake. Despite the fact that coal is unpopular, the fourth best performing commodity in 2021 was coal. The largest sales volume year on record for coal was 2021. The truth is that this transition to the carbon-free energy future may occur in 2050, 2060. But to get from here to there, we require carbon-based fuel. There's no way around it. I'm not advocating pumping more crap into the sky and pumping more crap into the water. What I am saying is that maintaining our current standard of living for 30 years requires fossil fuels. And that's before you lift the bottom half of humanity up to a standard that is right. higher than abject poverty. Do we need more solar power? Yes. Do we need more wind power? Yes. Do we need more geothermal? Yes. Do we need more hydro? Yes. Yes to all of them, all of that. We don't need solar in Germany where the sun doesn't shine. We need solar in India. We don't need solar at night. We need batteries or oil and gas at night. We need to have a realistic, pragmatic view of the requirements of humankind relative to the ability of various energy sources to source to supply it. And right now, irrespective of the narrative, that's done, particularly with transportation, with carbon.
Right. All right. So it sounds like you're saying, yes, if we want to have the economy continue to operate at the rate at which it has been from a status quo standpoint, we're going to need to have some sort of pivot where funds come back into this space to allow us to continue to do that. And again, folks, not trying to make a judgment call one way or the other. We're right. just trying to talk practicalities here. Right. So the one fuel source or one fuel source you didn't mention there was nuclear. And I'd love to get your thoughts on that, because I'm assuming that maybe this is what's going on right now is all of a sudden making policymakers reconsider nuclear a bit. In fact, they were before the outbreak of hostilities in Ukraine, where I'd read relatively recently that they were trying to get it classified as a green fuel to basically help address some of the shortcomings countries like Germany were suddenly finding themselves in. Give us, you know, your general thoughts on nuclear, and then let's use that as a segue to talk about your upcoming conference on uranium, because that's just coming up in a couple of weeks, right?
Yes, nuclear is the one I'm the most bullish about in the near term. First of all, uranium worldwide sells for less than the cost of production. I think there's going to be lots of demand for oil, but oil at 130 is selling for twice the median average cost of production. Uranium right now is selling for $50 a pound, and the International Energy Agency suggests it costs $60 a pound to make it. So the world, fully looted, is producing 60 million pounds of uranium and losing $10 a pound a year doing it. Rather boring. The price of uranium has to go up, or else the supply of uranium goes away. And if the supply of uranium goes away, the lights go out. So your listeners need to ask themselves, what is a more logical conclusion? Will the price of uranium go up, or will the lights go out? Because that's the question. I think the answer is fairly clear. Two, the incentive price to produce a pound of uranium is going up rapidly because of inflation in the supply chain and because of social rents, which is to say taxation and taxes, and also regulation around the world. So when we talk about a market clearing price of uranium at $60, that's a 2021 number. The market clearing price for uranium in 2024 is probably $75 a pound. I think it's inevitable that the price of uranium goes from $50 a pound to $75 a pound, a 50% increase from here in the 2 to 3 year timeframe. And I think that there's a substantial chance that the price of uranium overshoots, because even if the price of uranium goes to the market clearing price, it's a capital intensive business with very long permitting times. And you can't just add supply with the flip of a switch. It could be 10 years before we impact supply. The second thing is what you suggested. There is the wind of political change in Europe and in particular in Japan. The current oversupply of uranium came as a consequence of the Fukushima disaster, where the second largest nuclear fleet in the world, the Japanese fleet, was taken out of production. The Japanese, if my memory has served me well, have returned 10 or 12 reactors to service out of 40 or 50. But importantly, they're permitting another 18. For calendar 2022. If that happens, it will increase demand for uranium worldwide by about 10 million pounds. This demand will occur in a world where demand has already increased to pre-Fukushima levels as a consequence of nuclear plant construction, particularly in China. Then there is the increasing reality around the world that nuclear is a requirement for carbon-free baseload power, and also a renewed understanding in both Europe and Japan of the strategic benefits of uranium. The Japanese have favored uranium for years because a fairly small amount of uranium in inventory in Japan could power Japan Inc. for 5 or 6 years They didn't have the ability to store that much natural gas, that much coal, or that much oil, never mind that much rain for hydroelectric. So the energy security argument for Japan, which became apparent to them during the Arab oil embargo in the mid-70s, has reared its ugly head again, both in Japan and Europe. So of all the energy commodities and all the energy commodity equities that I'm bullish about on a timely basis, uranium is number one.
All right. I have a lot of questions I'd love to ask you about that, including where you see the biggest opportunity to invest. But I know that the real details are going to be shared at your conference, you know, with a lot more exploration of exactly what's happening in that space. So can you just give us the quick backstory on what's going to be talked about at the conference?
Yeah, happily. You know, Adam, that I've created natural resource portfolios for people for free for years. About 7,000 of those portfolios in the last 2 years have been uranium centric. And by looking at those portfolios, I've determined fairly well what at least 7,000 people did right and what 7,000 people did wrong. And understanding that we were coming out of a period where there was no interest in uranium to a period where there was going to be high interest in uranium, what I've done is designed an 8-hour online course, Uranium Investors Bootcamp, which will air March 19th. It'll be available on a delayed basis for people who can't attend on March 19th. But it will address what I consider to be the principal oversights that uranium investors have been guilty of in the last 2 or 3 years. To begin with, we'll talk about the global and domestic geopolitics of uranium, because it's an unusually politically inclined fuel. But importantly, too, we'll give a great overview of the uranium industry, supply and demand, and the fuel cycle. That'll be done by WMC Energy, who has joint ventured with Sprott in managing the Sprott Physical Uranium Trust. They did an hour-long presentation, an overview for the Sprott board about 6 months ago. And it was simply the best 1-hour-long presentation on uranium that I've seen in 45 years of studying uranium. I would suggest that the overview itself is worth the cost of the course. But in addition to that, you will have China General Nuclear, the Chinese parastatal firm, talk about the nuclear industry supply and demand from a Chinese perspective and China's strategic initiative to increase their uranium consumption. You will hear from Kazatomprom, the largest and finest uranium producer in the world, both in terms of the uranium structure globally and the geopolitics of uranium in Kazakhstan. Importantly, you will hear from Cameco, the most important North American producer and the largest capped uranium company in the world. You will hear too from uranium analysts, both buy side and sell side, but importantly, people who have 20 or 30 years experience in the uranium business. A lot of information that's being distributed about uranium online now is being displayed by very smart pundits, but people who 5 years ago couldn't spell uranium. And the faculty that will talk at our course are people who experienced the last uranium bear market and the last uranium bull market. The course costs $99 and the financial risk is mine. If you pay me the $99 and you attend the course and you think you didn't get your $99 worth, no questions asked, send me an email, I'll send you back your money. Just come prepared to work. We barely could constrain the material that we had to teach in 8 hours. You will be able to listen to it over several days if you don't have 8 hours available on March 19th. This is not information that'll be stale dated April 30th.
All right. Well, I think people have been furiously taking notes about this. That sounds wonderful. And what more can you ask? It is a money back guarantee if you don't like it. But I highly suspect, Rick, you're not going to get any takers on that, knowing the quality of the work that you do. So for folks that are interested in learning more about this this conference and potentially registering for it, go to wealthion.com/virtualuranium. It's the Virtual Uranium Bootcamp. That's right. Why we have that name there. All right. Well, Rick, look, I got more questions that I'm going to have the ability to go through in the time we have left. So we're going to kind of do rapid fire here, if that's okay with
you. Great.
I want to get to a few other commodities we didn't talk about yet. But before I do, there are a number of people a few weeks ago who saw, you know, at the outbreak of what happened in Ukraine, saw a number of world-class Russian commodity producers, number of which you've mentioned on programs with me in the past that you thought were, you know, had some of the best deposits in the world, watch their stock prices get cut in half and then cut in half again and cut in half again. And I think several people, you know, thinking that, well, maybe this might be a short-lived conflict that might get to resolution quickly. And I've certainly seen reports about people who bought in, only to have the Western exchanges basically take those shares off the exchanges. I know nobody knows what's going on right now, but I'm sure there are folks watching that have the question of, did I just lose all my money, or is there potential that these stocks might get really, you know, provided that things simmer down, that is there potential that these stocks could be relisted and eventually go back to their former levels?
The probability is that the big thinkers of the world find a way out of the box that they fought themselves into. And the consequence of that is that the world would return to some form of normalcy. I personally have relatively large holdings in the Russian stocks, not large enough that if I lost all the money I had invested in them, that it would change my decision as to what to have for breakfast, but it would certainly be aggravating. To the extent that the Russian shares relist, depending on their price, I'm wrestling myself with the moral question about how much support that I want to provide the Russian economy, given not that the United States isn't guilty of extraterritorial enforcement of our own political will, but there is a moral question that one must ask oneself about the efficacy of Russian investments. The economic discussion is a very different circumstance. Those companies were priced at half the price of their global peers before the invasion.
So right, several, I think, in PEs of like 2 or 4.
Companies that were 50% undervalued in commodity prices that had to go higher have now been through a 75 or 80% off sale. It's difficult unless you are a account holder in either Amsterdam or in Switzerland to take advantage of that. The Russians are out of the SWIFT system, and so you can't pay for those stocks, and the Russians can't pay you dividends. They have been delisted in London. It may be that they're ultimately nationalized. I can't say what's going to happen. I can say that, as an example, if you look at what I regard as the big six, Lukoil, Gazprom, Polymetal, Polyrus, what am I missing?
Nor Nickel.
Each of these companies in a normalized circumstance from their prices 5 days ago could be 10 baggers over 10 years without dividends. I'm not saying that they're going to be. What I'm saying is that these are the cheapest natural resource stocks on the planet by a country mile. They're cheap precisely because of the risk. The Russians could nationalize them. They could never relist. You could be stuck with a semi-private company trading on the Moscow Stock Exchange. Not my idea of a good time. I've been there before, by the way. But another thing could happen. We could have some return to normalcy. Sanity could prevail. I realize that's a difficult concept if you're talking about politicians, but sanity could prevail. And if that happened, you have a circumstance where you receive extraordinary dividends in stocks that generate penny stock returns. It's important that people who listen to what I just said take account of their financial and psychological ability to take absolute risk and to stomach volatility. If you take advantage of this, I'm almost certain that over the next 3 or 4 months, watching television news will not be good for your sanity.
That implies that it is on a normal basis, which I think we'd both maybe argue against. Well, thanks for answering that. A number of people submit that question over social media, so I appreciate you answering it. And just to sort of recap it to make sure I got it right, you've said, look, first and foremost, you got to decide sort of your personal ethics about whether you want to be in them or not. But it sounds like you're saying, as far as we know, they're not dead yet. They're just frozen. And if things were to resolve, there's a chance that they might come back on, you know, on the exchanges at some point. And if that were to happen, they were super cheap when they got frozen. They will probably, you know, do fairly well over the next 10 years if the country risk doesn't come back to bite everybody again. So,
correct.
All right. So real quickly, we talked about oil. We talked about uranium. lots of other commodities out there. Are there any particular ones right now, given what's going on right now, that you think look like either particularly good prospects or particularly bad prospects?
I think the high quality precious metals producers are cheap. I think the gold price goes up much higher, not because of geopolitical risk, but rather because of paying for geopolitical risk. I think geopolitical risk gives the big thinkers of the world the ability to continue with debt and deficits. I think it gives them the ability to continue counterfeiting. I think it argues for a continuation of negative real interest rates, which means I think that the gold price goes higher. And I think that the gold companies on a net present value basis are already cheap relative to the gold price. So the high quality producers, the guys that are generating large free cash flows that have 10 or 12 years of reserves and resources that are polite enough to pay decent dividends while you wait, are anomalously cheap, particularly given the outlook that I see for gold as a consequence of government action.
Okay, and so when you talk about these big, well-run companies, I assume it's sort of the same list that you gave when you appeared on this program almost a year ago.
Yeah, I
remember all of them. But
I can be much more generous now. At that point in time, I didn't see the big thinkers of the world having the excuse to continue to counterfeit, having the excuse to steal from savers on behalf of spenders through negative real interest rates. Now I see the continuation of the idiocy of the status quo for a long time. So you can come all the way down into names, the sort of B2 golds, West African golds, the smaller companies that I didn't have the courage to mention on your show a year ago. Certainly looking at the Barricks of the world, the Franco-Nevadas of the world, the Wheaton Preciouses of the world, the highest and best quality gold producers of the world makes sense. But now you can look at the Endeavor Minings of the world, companies that are generating enormous free cash margins, so enormous that they are faced with, how do they return capital to shareholders? Do they increase the dividends or do they buy back stock? These are very high quality questions for investors.
All right. Well, there are going to be a lot of people who I think are going to be very appreciative of that answer, because we've had a lot of people since we've launched Wealthion who've been following the gold industry very closely. And we're talking on a day where gold hit an intraday record high. It's come back a little bit off the heights. I think it closed around 2050 or so. But it sounds like you're saying you think that there's good probability that it could still go a fair amount higher from here.
Unless you believe that we're going to have an end to quantitative easing, which is to say counterfeiting, unless you believe that we're going to balance our budget, and unless you believe that we're going to return to a real interest rate, that is to say a nominal interest rate above the rate of inflation, gold is very, very, very likely to go higher. Think of yourself, Adam, not now as a financial commentator. Think of yourself as the manager of one of the largest pension funds in the world. You've lived through 40 years of benign economic climate, and your responsibility is to provide for the economic well-being of your pensioners 20 years from now. You've been taught that 40% of your portfolio has to be in bonds, both for the current yield and also for the security of principal. And now you wake up understanding that 40% of your portfolio guarantees that you won't be able to meet your sworn obligation.
Right. It's a mathematically guaranteed negative return.
What can you do? What will you do? I'm not suggesting that they're going to sell all of their bonds. I'm suggesting that there's going to be disintermediation out of bonds among the biggest institutional investors in the world because of negative real interest rates and because of inflation. And I'm suggesting that some of that disintermediation will go to gold. I'm suggesting, too, that gold as an asset class is tiny. 0.5% of the savings and investment assets of Americans are denominated in precious metals or precious metals related assets. The 30-year mean is 1.5%. If the disintermediation, the forced disintermediation of the biggest institutional investors in the world out of the debt asset class into other asset classes occurs, it makes sense to me that some of that money will go into an asset class that has a proven history to fight inflation. And the consequence of that is that demand for precious metals and precious metals related assets will at least return to 3-decade mean, which will lead to a tripling in demand for precious metals and precious metals related securities. I don't think that's asking too much.
Okay. And so when you say a tripling in demand, does that more or less imply a tripling in price over the next
I have no ability to how to correlate the two. I've never seen a five-year tripling in demand. I will tell you this, Adam. I know you're trying to get a number that makes a good headline. And I'm
that's okay.
I can tell you this. I've lived through two precious metals bull markets in my life. And everybody, including myself, underestimates their dimension. My first bull market, the price went from an admittedly price-controlled $35 to $850. My second bull market, the price went from $253 to $1,900. When people say, Rick, in this market, the price of gold has already doubled, don't you think it's over? If past this prologue, no, I don't think so.
All right, that's great context. Thanks. And the silver bugs would be all over me if I just didn't ask you your thoughts on silver. I assume you're similarly positive on silver's prospects.
My experience has been in the second half of a precious metals bull market. We aren't out of the first half yet. In the second half of a precious metals bull market, silver handily outperforms gold. It's more volatile. It has a lower unit cost. And silver unusually is in the doghouse in terms of investor sentiment. There's nothing I like more than a commodity that I think is going to run where everybody else hates it. People are bored of silver. It might be that silver doesn't reward you for a year and a half, but I've come to live in 5 or 6 year cycles. And I think the upside relative to the downside in silver for speculators is probably second only to uranium in terms of attractiveness.
Okay, well, that's a big vote of confidence. Last question on commodities is agriculture, just the one sector we haven't really talked about here yet.
Yep. You know, food prices, over the last 40 years have declined from 30% of consumers' wallets to 15%. Could we have a reversion to mean? Perhaps. People look at the fact that the wheat price is up substantially, but they don't compare it with historical means. The truth is that we've been through a period that has been extremely benign to the world's consumers in terms of food prices, and that's over. It's just over. At the same time that we've taken food from 30% of the average budget to 15% of the budget, we've increased the utility of that because we deliver so many more solutions now than raw food. Everything that you see at the grocery store, pre-chopped lettuce, TV dinners, stuff like that, that's all occurred in the context of food prices declining by half in real terms over 35 or 40 years. Are higher commodity prices here to stay? Absolutely. Realize, too, that when we talk about 1.2 billion people on Earth, who have no access to electricity, we have a billion people on Earth who experience food insecurity. We've done a wonderful job in the last 30 years of lifting up the poorest part of humankind. But all of those people, Adam, want to live like you and I. When a very poor person gets more money, they lift the per capita calorie count in their household from 1,200 calories to 1,800 calories. I'm not suggesting that that's necessarily good for health, but from the point of view of a poor person, that's a real increase in utility. And those people increasingly will compete with you and I for the basic stuff of humankind, including food, energy, and materials.
Okay, so looks like you look through the whole spectrum of commodities here, and it's almost like, you know, there's a winning argument to be made for just about every player on the board there. It's a great time to be Rick Rule.
Don't pay attention to narrative. You got to look at these companies by companies by companies. It is not true that because the gold price goes up, the shares of Amalgamated Moose Pasture, some penny dreadful exploration company is going to go up. You have to be applied in how you pay attention to this. But if you are applied and we don't have a worldwide recession or depression, this is going to be a very, very easy 5 years.
All right. Well, I know people are hoping that it is and that they're able to take advantage of the great direction that you've given them here. Rick, I really could go for a whole another hour with you. Unfortunately, I got to wrap it up here. I am going to give people a couple of free resources here. So folks, take out your pencils. The first is I've gotten a lot of questions about where can people buy precious metals. As Rick said, interest in them is really coming back online. And given the outlook, as Rick just said, a lot of people are waking up to the fact that if you're concerned about inflation, if you're worried about quantitative easing, if you're worried about, all the things that we just talked about here, it's pretty hard not to come to the conclusion that every portfolio probably needs some precious metals in it. So if you're looking for two good places to either buy precious metals and have them shipped to you directly, so you hold them in your hot little hands, go to wealthion.com/goldsilver, and we'll redirect you to our partners there. And if you're looking to own bullion but have it stored remotely for you in a secure Brinks vault in the location of your choice, either in the US or internationally, go to wealthion.com/HAA, and we'll direct you to the Hard Assets Alliance. Those are companies I've worked with for years and years, and full disclosure, their investors, I share some investors with Wealthion in those companies, which means I know the people involved very personally. Secondly, if you want to get assistance in perhaps making any investments in these producer companies, either the specific ones that Rick mentions or other ones that you're finding through your research, if you're not an experienced investor in investing in these yourself, highly recommend that you invest in them under the tutelage of a professional financial advisor who has a lot of experience in the space, can look at your own personal portfolio and give personalized recommendations to you of how much makes sense to put into them, because they are volatile. They are, you know, fairly speculative in many cases. And also perhaps maybe put hedges in your portfolio just to protect some of the downside. If you don't have a good advisor to work with on that, just talk to the ones that Wealthion endorses. You can talk to them just by filling out the quick form at wealthion.com. And most importantly, if you want to attend Rick Rule's virtual uranium bootcamp coming up on March 19th, go to wealthion.com/virtualuranium, and we'll direct you there in terms of learning more about the conference and how to register for it. Rick, thanks so much for joining me. Everybody, if you'd like to see Rick on this program again, please give him a great big thanks by hitting the like button and then clicking on the subscribe button below if you can. Rick, can't thank you enough for your time. Thank you so much for joining us and giving us so much of your expertise on this very, very fluid and frenetic week.
Adam, as a final note, any Wealthion shareholder who cares what I think about their portfolio can find out directly. Go to ruleinvestmentmedia.com, enter your natural resource portfolio. I echo what you say, Adam, about getting professional assistance if you're not prepared to devote full time to this. I will. I'm not a broker, so I won't manage your account, but I will rate your natural resource portfolio 1 to 10, 1 being best, 10 being worst, and I'll comment on individual issues where I think my comments might have value. In addition, if you're looking to borrow money against your physical precious metals holdings, I'm celebrating retirement by starting a new chartered bank, which will do precisely that. If you care about that, on the question and answer session of the rankings thing, add bank. Finally, if you care about private placements, because I'm not a broker anymore, I can give you notification for free about private placements that I participate in. I'm not soliciting you because I'm not a broker. I don't get paid. But if you're an accredited investor and you want to know what I'm doing with my own money for free, in the question section of the rankings database, enter the word placement. So rankings, if you care about the bank, write bank. By the way, it's an organization, yet it doesn't exist yet. If you care about placements, write placements. Thank you so much, Adam. Ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like me to be back, I hope to be back. So tell Adam that you want me back. Bye.
All right, Rick. Thanks so much. Thanks for watching, everyone.
Thank you.